session number 11939.
Row 9.
Mr. John L. Williams, Reel 9. About what time did you reach Berg, Mr. Williams?
Well, confusing then, but I suspect, and I think it was about the 24th of May. The 23rd of May. And we came there, and the town itself was a small, most interesting-looking town because it had its medieval walls all round it with little turrets round the wall. There were canals running round it, one running underneath the wall and coming down the main road, with two roads on either side of the main canal. The troops who were withdrawing down the road, okay, and moving off, we'll say, in a northwesterly direction towards Dunkirk and the beaches. To Bray Dune and places like that. When we got there, the inhabitants were still there. And shortly after arrived, there was some quite heavy bombing, because obviously the Germans were bombing the retreating people, and quite a few civilian casualties. We had some slit trenches behind the wall where we could look out, and as I believe I mentioned before, the very network of canals on the eastern side had been flooded, the lock gate had been opened, and it had turned into an expanse of water with a few causeways above it. It was in those causeways where we were going, and we had patrols in position and so on. And I think I realise now, I didn't realise at the time, it was the Germans were getting close up to there, and Hitler had given that instruction for them to stop and not break through the perimeter. So we were obviously encountering patrols and lightly held positions. The Germans weren't being very antagonistic towards us in that respect. And they were obviously just holding there. Well, we got a certain amount of artillery, and as a measure of my ignorance, the first artillery shells we got, I thought was ack-ack. Until this captain of the Royal West Kents, who was an old soldier of the 1418 War, told me that it was field artillery. But we were very heavily Stukaed, very regularly Stukaed.
What effect had the Stuka on yourselves and the people around you?
Well, it was quite devastating, because they came screaming down and dropped their bombs. And the first effect was to make us dig very deep. But I had to keep moving across the place, as I said, the sergeant major and so on. There were casualties, some quite heavy sometimes. And it was very demoralizing without any doubt. The noise and everything, it's difficult to express my feelings. I had a responsibility. And responsibilities, I always say, are very good, because they keep you thinking about other duties, not yourself. But it was very breathtaking. And lick-lipping, you know, your mouth went dry and so on. And as the British soldiers were passing through and we were pulling people out, and then some were deserted when it got dark and that sort of thing, and there was a continuing flares and lights and so on at Dunkirk, which was about 12 kilometres away, and the continuous pounding of the multiple machine guns of the naval vessels, which were obviously chasing up and down and blasting away at the aircraft. I remember on one occasion when there was the road and then there was a canal and there was an expanse there in front of the thing where we dug in. We had to dig in front of the fortifications to get a field of fire, you might say, if it became necessary. But we also had some little shelters behind the high wall, which we dug in as well. The Germans, there was a gateway, a medieval gateway, and the Germans did some very accurate artillery shooting on that. In one or two cases, they put artillery shells through the gateway and into the town itself, without bothering to go over the top. On one occasion, I remember, there was one of these roadmen's boxes, these like small sentry boxes, which roadmen use, with some pegs in, where they obviously used to hang their jackets up when they were working. And the sound made, we had our small packs on all this time, because there was nowhere to leave them. And the sound major said, "Oh, my back's bloody near breaking," he said. And he took his small pack off and hung it up on the pegs inside this workman's hut. And I was talking to him, and suddenly heard the scream of a Stuka coming, and I said, "Watch out, sound major," and dived onto the ground. He flopped head and shoulders into this small hut. There was a tremendous crash. It must have been very near, because I found myself up to the waist in the canal, holding on to two tufts of reeds and facing the opposite way to which I'd been standing before. And I looked up and I said, "Sergeant Major," and I got no reply. And I rushed across and he was still lying down, slightly stunned, head first, just his head and shoulders inside this. I said, "Are you all right, Sergeant Major?" Well, it transpired that a big chunk of shrapnel or debris of some sort had cut right through his small pack, which had a tin of McConaughey in it. And the McConaughey, as he was head and shoulders in the McConaughey stripped down up the back of his neck, and if, when I saw him pulled out, he put his hand up and I said, "God almighty, he's clotting us with bloody fish now." Because there's mess out of the McConaughey tin, you know. And on another occasion, where we'd been held up for a while, and then the captain told us that we were surrounded, and there wasn't much hope of getting out.
Any idea about what time?
Now, I suspect that must have been somewhere about the 25th or 26th. Somewhere like that. Perhaps a little later, perhaps the 27th. And he said, I think he said it was the Sherwood Foresters. Now, don't ask me which brigade or division they were probably trying to break through and open the place up again. I should say at that time, there'd been a considerable fall away in the number of refugees coming through, in the way, British Army refugees, I'll call them, coming through. And the sergeant major said, "You tell her that," because we had these downright infantry. We hadn't had any casualties among these lads. Again, I say it was because of good soldiers that dug in and did as they were told. And also we belonged to each other, you know. And the sergeant major said, "You can tag better than I can. Tell the lads the position." So these lads were sitting alongside the canal bank, and I told them, I said, "We're in a spot. They think we're surrounded. The Sherwood Foresters might break in and help us, but if not, there's a likelihood we'll either be dead or taken prisoner." I said, "Well, now, get yourself smartened up. There's the bloody canal. Get yourself shaved and cleaned up. So if you're going to die, you look like bloody soldiers, and if you're taken prisoner, the Germans will think you're real soldiers." And there's like laughter at that, you know. And one of our hard cases was chewing a piece of grass, and he looked at the sergeant major, Christopher Carruthers Armstrong. Even I didn't dare use his Christian name. I always call him Sergeant Major. And he said, "Well, kit lad, it looks as though we're buggered." And the Sergeant Major looked at him. He said, "Now, it's all right, Sergeant Major. I wouldn't dare call you kit if I thought there was any bloody chance of getting out." And everybody just the shrieks of laughter. Whether some of it was hysterical or not, I don't know. But we got them smartened up. And they did come through. It was also around about that time I moved back through the gateway for something, and some of these other troops were coming in, and there was a brigadier. So as I walked past him, I was carrying my rifle at the trail, at the shoulder, right infantry style. As I passed him, I flipped him, head nice to right, and my hand across in light infantry style. He said, "Come here, Sergeant." He said, "Why don't you salute me properly?" I said, "I did, sir." He said, "We want none of the slackness." Said, "You know how to salute. You should come up to the shoulder, come up to the slope, and give me a proper butt salute." I said, "No, I shouldn't, sir. I'm light infantry. The only time I'd give you a butt salute was if I was a sentry on sentry go. In the light infantry, I was giving you a proper salute." He said, I don't want to hear any more of this bloody nonsense. And there was one of his staff said, sir, the sergeant's right. If you're a light infantry, he gave you a proper salute. But I don't want any of this bloody slack morale. And so this was with shells dropping into the typical old-fashioned belief, that the ranks must be kept to do their duty and so on.
As the main body of people coming out through the town, out of Clyde, were you getting the better troops coming in?
Well, we had these two, and then they went off to a flank somewhere. I think they moved further up northwest towards Bray Dunes. And then we began to get stragglers coming through, because we were still in position, and nobody had told us to give up. Very few. And I remember on one occasion, I'd left covering the gate. I'd left the boys' anti-tank rifle. And it was just about twilight, and I heard what to my feverish moment, an armoured vehicle coming down through the town, over the cobbles, clattering down. And I shouted to one of my men, who shall be nameless at this stage, he's dead now. He died after the war. He wasn't killed in the war. I said, get onto that, boys, what's that gateway there? And he took one horrified look at me, heard, and dashed away somewhere. And I raced across at a very high speed of knots and flung myself down, and then had the most agonizing sort of situation, because I was heaving and panting so much I couldn't keep the boys' anti-tank rifle still, And I held my breath a while, just as it got near, and I was just about to press the trigger, and it was a British carrier came through. There was a very tired-looking officer driving it, and two or three men. And he said, I said, you gave us a fright there, sir. I said, we're nearly putting an anti-tank bullet into you. He said, I said, which is the way to Dunkirk? And I said, well, there you see the flames and that. So he just dashed off like that. And there were fewer and fewer people. It was getting rather eerie. And it was about that period when I began to think that things were a little bit tight. I believe I mentioned before how when the convoy came through, Colonel Simpson told Major Campbell Slattery, we weren't.
When you say eerie, what in what way?
No noise. Nothing coming down, and after all the clatter and so on, the odd one or two people coming down, no people coming, and we were moving up into the town. There were some dead civilian bodies all over the place. It was there where I had a bright idea, which probably would have caused me to be shot, because I saw a dead French civilian lying at the roadside, and I stopped and looked at him. He was about my height. He had a blue suit on and one of those flat corduroy caps. And I said to myself, if the worst comes to the worst, I'm changing clothes. I'm not being taken prisoner. So I pulled his body in behind the broken wall of a house, in case anybody came round to collect it, so that I knew where there was a suit which I was going to change into, how I was going to do it, and what would have happened to me if the Germans had found me, a British soldier, in a civilian suit that God knows about. But that was just my idea at the time.
The other people who obviously were with you at the time, how were they taking the news that you probably weren't going to get out?
Well, the light infantrymen, now this is terrible, it sounds as though... But we were all together, and they knew that, we told them, we stick together, and whatever happens, we'll be together. And so we had a sense of belonging, but a lot of these other people were very, very worried. And one night, we had 110 people on this perimeter place, and the next morning we had 65. They just floated in the night towards the burning horizon, that sort of thing.
And were these from a hodgepodge of you?
These were the hodgepodge of people, the Royal Engineers. There were still some of these pioneers. All sorts of odd people which had pulled out. A lot, little did they know, it was because they had a rifle. Because a lot of these people were fleeing in all directions. But when I look back now, it was a terrible situation, really, And I also remember we got, one of the days towards the end, we got badly stuckered. We were in a slit trench. I was in with a sergeant major. And there was a big lot of debris and so on dropped in on top of us. And I had a great dent in my helmet from a bit of rock which had hit the top of my helmet. And my nose was bleeding slightly. And my steel helmet come down. Cut my nose, and I was bleeding out my nose and also my skin. And I wiped myself down. And also, I had a naffy radio set which I'd, shall I say, got hold of. And I was hearing the programs from over the channel, you know, and this was one of these programs cheering everybody up about what was happening. And I remember in the midst of this Stuka raid, there was a band playing, oh Johnny, how you can love. Oh Johnny, heavens above. Anyhow, when that was finished, I set the sound major. I was wiping myself down, so I said, if I get back to England, sound major, do you know what I'm going to do? And he told me afterwards, he said, I thought your nerve had gone. Because he said to me in rather kind of, he said, what, lad? I said, the first bloody stop me and buy one, I say, I'm going to have an ice cream. Stop me and buy one, with these little pedal cars with sold ice cream, tuppence, threepence and fourpence. He said, you daft bug, he said, you put the wind in me, he said, I thought your bloody nerve was giving away. I'll tell you a secret of that when I get back to England as well. And we were there, and I was reporting this officer, this Royal West Kent captain. And then one night he told us, well, that's it. We make our break now. And again, with a certain amount of forethought, I had a 1500 weight stashed just round the corner. It was nobody's, and nobody's worrying about it, but it could work. So I said, just make a break on ourselves now. He said, yes. And he said, I'd like to thank you and the Sergeant Major very, very much indeed. And I must tell you quite frankly, when I was positioned to do so, I'd certainly make recommendations when I get back to England. Well, I said, I'm only sorry we've got to leave like this. And he shook hands with us. And then he made off somewhere where I don't know, and we were left. And everybody moved out then, and we were the last to go. It was a little bit selfish. I saw the rest of us, so they wouldn't know we had a 1500 weight. And then we got on this 1500 weight. Now, that must have been the 31st.
This was your own light infantry group?
Our own light infantry group, yes.
And were you the last, or was there still anyone left in the town?
There was nobody left in the town except dead civilians, as far as I can make out, or civilians who were in the cellar somewhere, you know. And certainly none of these people we'd put in positions were there. I noticed on a French map that the 31st, the Germans closed in. But it wasn't quite true, because they hadn't closed in on Berg when we left, you know. We travelled in the dark in a very diagonal, all seemed to be moving towards the light. And we finished up in the early hours of the morning on a beach at Bray Dune, not very far from the Belgian frontier. And
what was the picture of the scene? What was the scene then?
Well, we got on, and there were dunes, sand dunes there, and I got in, and the first thing I saw on the beach were a row of British soldiers standing out in the underwear with steel helmets on, curled out into the sea. And an officer and others on the sand here. There were a certain amount of bombing and shelling going on, and there were a whole lot of riderless French cavalry horses screaming up every time a bomb burst. They're screaming, rushing around in all directions with their stirrups slapping up against their bellies and so on, you know. And it was really, I was more frightened of being trampled to death by a French horse than it was of this shelling and bombing. And I said to the bloke, the sound major said, I'm a bit tired now. Will you sort of organise things? So I said, right, sound major, you keep the lads here and dig in and get under cover. But and I'll go down and see this officer down here where these men are standing in the water. And he was an officer, I think he was an artillery officer, a captain. And I went down to the beach edge and I tossed him up a salute. And I said, we have a section of Dermot Infantry, sir. What's the situation? And he said, oh, Christ, Sergeant, it's every man for himself. He said, now, if you want to join this lot here, he said, throw your rifle away and your upper garments and get in line. And as they take you off, you walk into the water. And I said, look, I'm sorry, sir, but I said, we're Dermot Infantry Territorials, and we signed for our rifles at our local drill hall. And I'd rather like the men and myself to take the rifles back. You can't go off here. He said, well, just a minute. He said, way down at Dunkirk, which was about a mile or so away, he said, there's a mole there. Now, I said, he's been hitting it from the Calais side and from this side all morning. But every now and then he seems to stop for half an hour or so. Now, I said, you could go down there. You'll have to go down the beach and take your chance, but he said, well, it'll be any better than here, I don't know. And I think we said, look, son, here's a cigarette, sit down and think about it. And the man was bothering. I don't know who he was. He was a hero as far as I was concerned, because all this other lot standing in the water, in the raw cellular and all sorts of things, you know. And I sat down and I was smoking a cigarette and I saw a seaman's body bobbing in on the water. And I think he must have been about 7 inches thick in yellow black fuel oil. And he said, I think that's the Wakeful. It had its stern blown off just down there. He said, I think this is some of the crew coming ashore. So I thought to myself, I took a few puffs at my cigarette. I thought, well, Williams, if you're going to die, you're going to die dry shot. So I said, well, I think so. I think I'll get my men and we'll move down and take our chance off the mole at Dunkirk. Well, it's up to you, son. May I wish you the best of luck and shook hands with me. And there was that man left with his monastery body. And he took the time to give me a cigarette and have a chat with me and shake hands with me. So I went back into the dunes, which wasn't very far, just about 50 or 60 yards. Got my blokes out and explained the situation. And I said, I want open order down the beach, debris and bodies all over. And you all know, you've all been taught, that the bolt for a British rifle is made specially for that rifle. So we go down the beach in open order, that's for safety's sake, bogey. We lie down if we come under direct attack. The only time you stop is if you see a rifle lying by itself, I want you to pick it up, take the bolt out and throw the bolt away. So that rifle will be no good to any German. Okay? And nobody stops unless I stop or unless we take shelter momentarily. And we went in open order down the beach, taking bolts out of rifles as our contribution to the war effort, you know. And we were going past, there were some blown up cars and so on, and suddenly this character, you know, the one who'd set the Sergeant Major, it looks as though we're bugger kids, you know. He said, Sergeant, I tell you, we stopped looking at the cars. Didn't I bloody well tell you to keep moving? He said, it's full of fags. We went back, and there was a dead staff officer. It seemed to be a brigadier's car there, and the driver dead, and there were some cigarettes in the back, so we filled up. And I said, right, now resume. And we walked the way down. And we got along onto the promenade part of Dunkirk and went along to where the mole was sticking out of the sea. As I discovered later, it was part stone and then part wooden staging at the far end. But, of course, the wooden staging had been blown. There were just the main beams remaining in many cases. And right at the end of it, an absolute shambles. There were MOs working on wounded people. There were wounded people lying on stretchers and people lying on a road and so on. So I said to my blokes, right, sling your rifles across your back. Now we'll make ourselves useful. Two men to a stretcher. I said to the MO, one of the MOs, this will go crash, yes, any helps. So take more. So we've got two men, and the Sergeant Major stayed till the last, till we got the lads moving along. And then the Sergeant Major, I took a fellow. He had his trouser cut off, and he had a big shell dressing over his thigh, and he was lying on the thing. And we took him off, and Jerry started bouncing him off the thing again, and her body's lying all the way along, and we moved on and put the stretcher down, leaned up against the wall. There was one side was a sort of wall, you know, but the other part sort of sloped down. I remember the first bloke I stopped against, or leaned up against, and he was lying on his face, and he had a small pack, and sticking out of his small pack was a little doll, obviously it's going to, and something had sliced the top of his head off. And the first time I'd realised, the shredded brains were up against the wall and dried. And they just looked like dried sort of mince, you know, up against the wall. And we stopped and got along. And then we got along to near, and we saw the staging, and you could see the grey sea. It seemed to be an awful way underneath. And the Sergeant Major said, put him down a minute, Sergeant, and just a moment. And we put the chap up against the wall, and he kept, he said, no. And he said, Sergeant Williams, if you feel yourself gunning, drop this bugger and hide on yourself. So farewell to Christian ethics and so on. Then anyhow, we managed to stumble across. One case, we're walking along wide beams, you know, and we got him across. And there was a boat tied up, and the first thing I noticed, it was bow onto us, And there was a great hole in the bow, just above the waterline, you know. And there was a thin captain with his naval cap on. He was a merchant ship, smoking a pipe and standing on the bridge and leaning on the bridge, you know. And we start loading people on. I had to go up the gangway holding this stuff. That was the most tiring thing I ever did in the war, that, but holding a stretcher up like that while we got them up the gangplank, because it was just a narrow gangplank. We got them on, and I pushed them in against the bulkhead, and the sound major clamped down. When I look back now, he would be a man about 45 or 40, and I looked upon him as an old man. I was 27, I might tell you, but he seemed to be completely clapped out. He also had been a soldier in the 1418 war. He said, I said, I'll sit here. And I said, I'll just have a mooch round. I walked around the deck, and they were, having read all these romantic stories, I suddenly said, you never thought you'd see blood running in the scuppers, did you? Because the thing was canted, and there were stretchers and bodies lying on the deck, and the blood was running across the deck and into the drainage section, you know. And I went round, and I saw a road down below. I went down where the galley was, and there was a big fat cook. I said, can you spare a drop of tea? I had my mess tin, two mess tins out. He said, I can't give tea for everybody. Come on, I said, nobody will know. So he gave me two pannikins of tea. And I remember another unsung deed. If anybody said, did you require a decoration for your bravery? And I said, yes. I walked across that bloody deck with the machine, and I didn't spill a drop. I went down like that once when the shell hit us. And I got him there, and I split it up. And I gave this army as a bit, and I gave this bloke on the stretcher drink. And we sat down against the bulkhead, and then came Sammy just lying there, and this character on the stretcher. I said, are you all right, lad? He said, yes. Then a bit of that, he said to me, Sarge, I want to pee. Well, I said, can you turn over on your stretcher and just pee over the side, run down the deck? There's all sorts on this deck, won't matter. Oh, he said, that's not very sanitary. I said, well, beggars can't be choosers. I said, no, I can't. And he got up and walked away and had a pee and came back and lay down on the stretcher. And the sound major looked and said, I'll murder that bugger. He said, we carried him all the way along that bloody mole. And I said, it's all right, he's probably suffering from some sort of shock. I didn't know what to laugh or cry, you know. And as we were sitting there, there was a ship, I presume, landing. And I saw, several yards of deck rail fly up in the air like a necklace, you know, it would hit. So we had ship there with blood running down the deck, and the part of the deck rail, we could have stepped over the side without any trouble, you know. And suddenly the engines took on enough note, and we started moving. And we went out to sea, and I noticed, thing I'd read about, the cables running around, you know, degaussing, you know, against magnetic mines all around the ship. And we got away out, we seemed to be well out in the channel, and a German seaplane came zooming up and dropped some mines in the sea. And we seemed to pause for a while, and then we went on. And then I saw that we were the ghost, you know, but nobody was telling anything. And then suddenly a destroyer came towards us, going a fair rate of knots, and it pulled round us, and an officer on the deck with a megaphone called, stand away from Dover and go into Folkestone. There didn't seem to be any change in our direction, England. And we pulled in and came bobbing into Folkestone. And I realised the reason we weren't making very fast rate was if we'd gone too fast and raised the bow wave, we would have been taking water in through this great gap in the bows.
Before we go into Folkestone, how long were on the mole between starting off your journey and getting on the ship?
Between starting off the journey?
At the mole, at the back end of the mole, and moving down it onto the ship, how long would you think that would take?
Somewhere about half to three quarters of an hour to get on board from the mole, because we were stopping in it when we were coming under shell fire and getting up and going.
What was the morale of the troops lined up? What was the atmosphere?
On the ship?
On the mole itself.
Oh, well, there were very few people on the mole. Except the dead lying there. And I remember one bloke passed us with his rifle and his shoulders hunched up like somebody walking in a hailstorm. But no words were passed, you know. But we were busy carrying this fellow, and quite frankly, but there were very few. We must have been very lucky to get that ship, because it started up, you know, it wasn't very long, a very short period of time before it sailed. And I realized afterwards that the captain was standing on the bridge there, ready to receive instructions. Obviously, they were operating under the orders of the naval and so on. And every now and then there was this destroyer people up and down the bay, sort of these pom-poms, these multiple machine guns, tearing away up in the sky, planes coming across.
Had you still any fears that you may not get back, that the journey may have been too dangerous for you?
No. Now, that's a peculiar thing. Once we got on board the ship, as far as I'm concerned, it was like being in England, you know? It was complete idiocy, because we weren't, it wasn't a safe thing, but I didn't worry at all from that point. I got a drop of char, saw this bloke, had this sort of hysterical giggle about this chap getting up and peeing over the rail and coming back lying on his stretcher and so on, and the sound major's noise and so on. And we tied up alongside a ship at Folkestone, and we had to wait quite considerable time because they were taking the wounded and the stretcher cases off. And then we went off, and when we got down there, there was some guards, soldiers. Some had a container, so they could shoot the contents of your rifle, 10 rounds out of your rifle, load it into this thing. And then somebody said, hand your rifle over.